Well, a big thank you to Darren and the team for driving us through the afternoon. It is Tuesday, July 22nd, and you are listening to Game On with me, Shane Dawson, alongside Ruby Walsh.
And coming up between now and the new music show at 7pm, Paul Curry and Mark Langan react to the FAI Thurground Cup draw and chat through all the latest football transfer news. Shane Stokes is the latest from the Tour de France, while Remy Burns reflects on Scotty Scheffler's open victory and what next for both Rory McIlroy and Shane Lowry.
Plus, we'll hear from Andy Farrell following the Lions' sluggish performance, yet they did come away with a win this morning. As always, if you want to have your say, you can text 51552, WhatsApp 0871879200, or find us on X at GameOn2FM.
This is 2FM's Game On.
It's a bit harsh to say it was a sluggish performance this morning, Ruby.
No. I don't think you were. Started well, lost it in the middle. That said, it was a magnificent day for Jamie Osborne.
Yes.
Called into the squad late from, they were in Portugal, I think, when he got the call up, weren't they?
Yeah.
And he's on the Lions team this morning and scores two tries. I mean, what a dream debut for him. And I'm sure not even something he could have dreamed of happening to him this season. But outside of that, from an Irish point of view, Gary Ringrose got on, played 62 minutes.
Probably played more minutes than expected.
Yeah. And I don't know, is that a positive or a negative?
Yeah.
You're guessing. Andy Farrell wouldn't be drawn after the game. Food for thought, etc., etc. We'll review the game tomorrow, have a meeting and discuss the team and announce it tomorrow evening. But I don't know, if you're an outsider looking in, maybe Hugo Keenan was happy. Blair Kinghorn threw a wild pass for an intercept. Probably, you know, that was maybe in the balance. But sure, he was happy with that. But I wonder, would Bundy Aki be the one that's worried? I don't know, Farrell was a standout player on the team.
Looking over his shoulder.
Yeah.
Perhaps. Speaking of Owen Farrell, we can hear from the man himself alongside Andy Farrell, who were speaking after the Lions' 24-19 victory this morning in their final of the midweek games before Saturday's test against Australia, the second test of this Lions series.
First and foremost, it's 100% congratulations to what was a great performance from the First Nations and Pacific Society. Showed exactly what it meant to them. They obviously talked a lot about how much they was enjoying their time together, and they showed a really tough nut to crack, especially when we went 14 points up, for them to stay in the fight like they did and put it to us for large parts of that game. They deserve a huge pat on the back. And then as far as the game's concerned, I thought 14 points up and finding space everywhere, we started to play the game a little bit like an exhibition match, and it was never going to be like that. So I was pretty pleased with how we readdressed that at half time and started showing some proper intent in our game. Whether we got the rewards from it or not is a different story, but we fought our way back in the game.
Darcy Graham, how is he? Obviously, understandably, really emotional when he...
Yeah, no, he's devastated, but to become a Lion and score a try as well, he should be unbelievably proud of himself.
And how pleased were you with Gary having to come on probably a bit earlier than was planned? And
yeah, we just had a conversation about that, but I thought he performed really well, so some real good positives as far as that's concerned. Jamie Osborne, for his first time wearing the shirt, I thought he was very good, and so were some others. I thought Ben White, to say that he's not been around for too long, I thought he was he controlled the game really well. Some nice individual performances out there.
So once again, have you got the selection headaches you would want?
Well, it's always been about the squad, and again, we'll assess where everyone's at. It's a different week for us with this game in between test matches, so we get to have a day off tomorrow and we're all into work together Thursday, Friday, so we'll see where we're at.
And the energy in your numbers by the plate?
How do you think you played?
Guess you.
Eh?
Some good things, obviously. Nice little chip off the left peg. Some nice touches on the ball as well, but always work on Murray. There's always work on.
Andy, some people tonight will have played their final game for the Lions on this tour. What's your message to those players?
I've said that I'm delighted for them to
to be put under a bit of pressure, and not everything going their way, but to find a way and to come out on top is great for those guys who don't manage to play again, that they're able to sign off that way.
Can I ask how much you two have enjoyed doing this thing together? It's a bit weird.
Yes.
And funny, isn't it? Father, son, coach, captain, job, right?
It is what it is. Have we done this before?
What? No.
Up here, you mean?
Well, oh. Just the last couple of days doing this together.
Oh, he's a part of the squad. He's a player. He's a captain. He's a leader of the squad, and it's a profession that we love doing. So that's how it is. And then I suppose we'll talk about it after the third test.
As a rugby fan, Ruby, does the Lions tour still capture your imagination? Are you enthused by it?
I have watched some of the games, Shane. I'd say that's probably the answer. No, I don't know.
Does it still hold a stature that it once did?
I think, yes, the test matches definitely do. And I think possibly because of the transition Australia are in, and it is a cycle, obviously it's 4 years' time, it'll be, I'm not sure, it's the All Blacks or South Africa, it just goes round. But I'd say with the transition Australia were in, it probably didn't float my boat as much as other Lions tests. When you were going to take on the world champions, you were going to take on a team that was completely in transition with world class players. So to be honest with you, I probably have expected the Lions to do what they're doing, whereas in most other Lions trips, you're hoping, could they possibly do it? And maybe that sense of could they rather than they will floated my boat more.
You've two of the nations above Australia in the world rankings, as it is, Ireland and England, that are competing, and then you add in, now I know Wales don't have a large contingent, but Scotland as well, so perhaps it should be a bit more plain sailing and straightforward, and probably will be a Lions victory come this weekend in the second test. Elsewhere in terms of news, just to mention, the Irish women's cricketers are in T20 action against Zimbabwe at Pembroke Cricket Club. Zimbabwe won the toss, elected to bowl, and Ireland ratched up 176 for 4 off their 20 overs. In reply, Zimbabwe are 50 for 2 off 9 overs, so 127 runs with 8 wickets remaining and 66 balls remaining if Zimbabwe are to win. Ireland won the first of the 3 match series as well. So perhaps the series will be wrapped up. We are chatting cycling a little bit later with Shane Stokes, but just to mention, because it was absolute drama at today, Ben Healy produced an astonishing climb up the legendary Mont Ventoux, but it was denied a second stage victory of this year's Tour de France by just 2 bike lengths. So unfortunate for Ben Healy, and we will be chatting to Shane Stokes a little bit later on that.
Game on. Association football.
But turning our attention to association football, Mark Langdon will be joining us shortly. But Paul Curry is in studio. Paul, how's the form?
I'm very well, Shane. Looking forward to the European Games this week. And obviously the big FAI Cup draw that took place today.
Yes, the big FAI Cup, the Sports Recommends FAI Cup third round draw that has paired St Patrick's, Athletic and Shelburne as one of 4 all Premier Division ties following the draw for the third round. Pats and Shells will clash at Richmond Park, while Derry City will host cup holders Drogheda United in a repeat of last year's final. Bows will take on Sligo Rovers at Dalymount Park, and there is an all Munster affair between Cork City and Waterford. Shamrock Rovers will host First Division strugglers Longford Town at Tallaght Stadium, the only non-league team left in the draw, or regional or divisional league, I don't like the phrase non-league. Sodhill Devon have been rewarded by taking on the only professional outfit in their county in Galway United. Despite just 5 First Division clubs being in the draw, there were 2 ties involving the teams from the second tier. Finn Harps will meet Bray Wanderers at Finn Park, with Kerry FC taking on Cove Ramblers. Standout tie for you there, Pat Shells, or a repeat of last year's final?
I'd probably say Pat Shells, and the reason being, we were speaking last week, Shane, talking about, you know, the European journey that Shells are on and where that could potentially take them this year.
needing to back that up with European qualification again at the end of this season, and really the best route for both of these sides is probably through the FAI Cup, given how well the likes of Shamrock Rovers, Bowes and Derry are going in the league at this moment in time and the points gap to those sides. So that game is going to carry so much weight for both of those sides to try progress in the competition and ultimately try secure the European spot that comes with winning the FAI Cup. So it's a really tricky draw. I think Shamrock Rovers will probably be absolutely delighted on the basis of a lot of Premier Division sides drawing each other and hoping that they can secure another good draw in the next round of that cup. But kind of looking at the way it's panned out, you know, they will be absolutely delighted with that. I'd fancy Derry to go through in that game at home, and I'd fancy Bowes to beat Sligo Rovers as well. But no gimmies at all at any stage of the cup competition, but it's certainly put together some tasty, tasty affairs.
The hottest ticket will surely be Salt Hill, Devon and Galway United, won't it?
It's always a nice bit of romanticism around that.
I'd say there'd be a lot of fight in that game.
There will. That might be moved to Galway's ground now.
It probably will, won't it?
Yeah, Eamon Deasy Park. You would imagine so. End of Curran,
would you,
I think.
If you were Salt Hill, would you move it?
I have to say, I remember travelling to Salt Hill, Devon when they were in the First Division, and it is both them and Merview United have heroic old school grounds. Really touch a class about the two of them. But it's a big call. Colestor Dunnecarney had to move their match last round to Daly Mount against Bowes. It's a payday. It's a big, big payday. Yeah. Realistically, you're probably not going to overturn. Realistically, Salt Hill aren't going to overturn a Premier Division side. So would you not just cash in on it?
Yeah.
Probably.
That is.
You're asking the wrong fella. Of course I would.
That's the argument. Would you, Paul?
Luckily I don't have to take those decisions.
A career in politics is for you. Well, you don't have to make those decisions, but you do make some statements on Twitter, Paul Curry. And the reflecting on the Sports Direct Men's FAI Cup second round, Paul Curry tweets, FAI Cup results once again reminding how pointless a third tier would be, a waste of time, money and resources. Is that not a bit harsh now in the counter argument, of course, predictable as it is, Paul Curry, that these regional sides, they're out of season, they're not going to be the most competitive here, that perhaps we need an aligned football calendar?
I don't disagree with that statement. I think it would make sense to have an aligned football calendar, but I'm not sure you would see too much of a difference in the results of the FAI Cup games. My point was more around resourcing the game here in the country and looking at how do we improve the best sides and make their facilities better, as opposed to trying to span out what is a pretty limited, you know, sum of cash that gets bucketed into the Irish game on a yearly basis. I don't see the point in trying to add another 10 teams to that investment and try and improve their facilities as well. Like, you look across, Shane, and to be honest with you, look at the Premier Division games that take place on whenever the next kind of round or full round of games take place. There's not a huge amount of players within the top teams who've come through the First Division teams, let alone sides outside of the top two divisions. Like, there's not a huge amount of teams that are actually contributing to the top players at the top end of the game. You look and you will find very few players who have come through the likes of Cove, Treaty, Wexford, Longford, Finn Harps, Kerry at loan. Like, people go on as if we need a third division because there's so much talent being lost to the game at a specific age. I don't see that argument. I just really don't see it. I think we should be focusing on getting 10 or 12 teams up to a certain level of standard from a facilities perspective, looking at training grounds and stadiums, and trying to get them up to a certain level before you start focusing on teams outside of, you know, that cohort.
Well, how many? What's in Shells, Rovers, Bowes squad? How many players are you talking?
Probably 18, I would have thought.
Yeah, 20 at the max if you include perhaps some of the underage.
The younger players who would come up and train who might not be full-time professionals.
Yeah. By 10 teams is 200. By two divisions is 400. So we're looking for a third tier then to be the next 200 players.
I think there's an argument though that you need a third tier, or at least we talk about the football calendar being aligned, but the football pyramid being aligned. Well, I don't.
Those pyramids don't exist. I hear about them in racing too. That's a mythical, but fictional.
You look at them. It's too fractured. you look at different leagues, even in I take it from a Dublin point of view, but it happens across the country that there's your Leinster Senior League, your AUL, your United Church League, your AFL. That's all well and good having different leagues because there's the amount of players, but there's no defined this is the best league for the best players and the best teams, and there's no structure in that regard. So at least with a third tier, now the counter argument to that then is perhaps not all the best teams will be applying to be in the third tier, so you're still going to have those fractures within the game that you mightn't have the best teams in the country applying for the third tier. You might still have someone playing in the Leinster Senior League that aren't under the FEI umbrella in that regard.
Yeah.
But you do need that.
Before you go, Paul Corey, how many people do you think played in those leagues that should have got an opportunity higher up that didn't get one?
Very few. I think very few.
That's the end of the argument then.
That's exactly where I would be with my opinion on this sort of conversation, Ruby. I actually think we've too many teams. I really do. I just don't see enough quality coming through from some of these clubs to justify.
Too many teams in the League of Ireland.
No. Across the two divisions. Like, if you take the 20 teams, I think there's six or seven teams who've contributed so little over the last 10 years to say they deserve, or, you know, we should be focusing, deserve is the wrong word, we should be focusing deploying resource into those clubs. I think you should be focusing on getting the top 10, 12, 15 sides up to a certain level and go from there. Now, I appreciate we need to focus on geographical reach, and there has to be regions taken into consideration. I'm not saying that we should focus solely on Dublin, but you have to look at where the talent is coming from and try put the support and infrastructure around those players. It's not as if there's an untapped region in Ireland at this moment in time that is miraculously just going to start producing numerous players and loads of talent
If you give them the platform for a second division or whatever, third tier, whatever name you want to put on it, because we've lost clubs, the likes of Monaghan United, Enfield, Kilkenny City, Thurles Town, Kildare County.
But how many players came through those clubs? Very few, Shane. Like, I'm looking at some of the teams there, and I could think of Wexford and the likes of a Lee Grace has come through there. You've Finn Harps and you've Coyle has come through there. But there's not a huge stream of players that come through these clubs. UCD have produced a number of players who've come through the scholarship system and gone on and played for Dundalk and Shamrock Rovers when they were successful. Dundalk have obviously got a couple of players who are still the likes of John Mountney and Cole, Michael Duffy, who have played at that club for a long period of time. There's not a huge number of players playing at the top Premier Division clubs today that have come through the first division.
No, it's a very valid argument. I just like.
I was having a bit of a rant on Twitter, and I don't tweet or X or whatever you say these days too often. But I do.
You're
not
Alan Colley.
No, I'm definitely not. I look at the results, and Alan would be the same. You know, you look at the results at this stage of the competition every year, and it seems as if the sides who aren't involved in the top two divisions are getting absolutely battered, and that's against some of the Premier Division teams who have changed like 6, 7, 8 players coming into that game. They've rested. It's almost like a second string that have gone out and produced these results. So and that's not to be critical of those clubs, because some of them are doing absolutely the best they can. But I just think it rules out the argument of the need for a third division.
Build them, they will come. No? No, perhaps that you put the structures in.
Going the other way at it. Why not build the underage academies? Obviously Marie has done a docu-series on that.
Live on RT this Thursday.
Yeah, when you get someone like, say, Sean Keogh at Dundalk now going to Brighton and Hove Albion, like, how long ago is it since Dundalk was nearly closed down? And there's the finances going back in. So should we not be building could they not be building the academies and be keeping those young lads in Ireland till they're that age to turn them into money for the Irish clubs?
Yeah, I think that is a fair counter argument. I think what it is going to require, though, it's probably going to require clubs coming together and trying to centralise those resources and having their better players trained together. I don't think we have the luxury of having so many clubs within certain regions, or having, you know, two first division teams maybe situated close together and having them compete against one another. I think you need to get the best training with the best in the best environment and the best facilities. Like, our facilities as well, by the way, are stone age compared to what you get across Europe. Like, we are so far behind that we should be focusing, in my eyes, on getting a certain number up to a certain standard.
Yeah, there are some stark figures in that documentary that Marie Crowe was part of in terms of the broader picture of having the amount of academy staff, and it's startling, and it's horrendous, and it is absolutely blocking progress of Irish football as well. But it's divided. We see the likes of Bowes having links with St. Kevin's and Home Farm and other teams, St. Joseph's, trying to link up with League of Ireland clubs to create that pathway, but it's still fractured. And
that move for Sean Keogh to Brighton is a brilliant example of what can be done if you can support players and give them opportunities to go and play. And you'd be looking to replicate that as much as you possibly can.
For sure. On that storyline, Dundalk fullback Sean Keogh expected to secure a move to Premier League side Brighton this week. It's understood that an undisclosed six-figure sum has been agreed between the two clubs for the services of the 19-year-old, with the County Louth side securing future add-ons to what is believed to be a record sale for Dundalk. So a left full Ireland under 19 international has been a regular for Dundalk as well. Some League of Ireland transfer news elsewhere. Shelburne must plan without first-choice goalkeeper Conor Kearns for tomorrow's Champions League second-round qualifying first leg tie against Azerbaijani champions Karabakh at Tolka Park. Shell's manager Joey O'Brien confirmed that the Reds keeper, who went off injured in last week's first round qualifier against Linfield, has a hamstring strain and will be out of action for a number of weeks. So Joey O'Brien has confirmed that Lorcan Healy will start tomorrow against Karabakh. However, Shell's did announce this afternoon a signing of a goalkeeper, Wessel Spiel, joining on loan from Minnesota United, a 23-year-old Dutch goalkeeper joining on a deal until the end of season, subject to international clearance. Spiel has made appearances in both the US Open Cup and MLS this season. Began his career in the Netherlands with Utrecht before making the move to the United States. So three MLS appearances, six goals conceded. So they're the facts at the moment. But he did very well in collegiate football over there. And Lorcan Healy starting tomorrow. Who knows who will be the Shells number
it's
one?
It's got to be a bit of a concern for Shells. Conor Kearns is out.
Yeah. Having just that relationship with your two centre-halves. And it was funny, we were talking on the show yesterday, Ruby, and about kind of, will Ringrose and Aki start instead of the two Scots and building those relationships. Your relationships, I know you weren't the centre-half, but the relationship between your defenders and your goalkeepers, absolutely crucial.
Oh, yeah. 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 And you really need to kind of iron out some of those poor errors that Shell's made against Linfield, because Carabao will take advantage of that chain.
They most certainly will.
I could sense that in the body language coming from Shane Dawson there as he mimicked the relationship between the goalkeeper and the centre-back.
I have full faith in Lorcan Healy tomorrow night and full faith in Wessel Spiel should he be given the opportunity, the 6'7" Dutchman. Those FAI Cup ties, just to mention, will be played on the week ending August 17th, one of which will be broadcast live on RT Television on the Saturday evening. Perhaps a few League of Ireland fans might have tickets for Oasis that weekend, so there might be a few plans being rearranged for those League of Ireland matches. However, Mark Langdon does join us on the line as we continue our transfer talk. Evan Ferguson to Roma. We didn't touch on this one yesterday. We have in previous shows, Mark, but what would be the major obstacles, or would you be in favour of this move to progress Evan Ferguson's career in Serie A?
Oh, no, I'd always encourage any players, to try new things. And, Evan Ferguson just needs to play. That's the main thing. He just lacks rhythm, lacks minutes. You think to where he was a couple of seasons ago. I mean, I remember people suggesting he could be a £100 million centre forward. And, could have been linked with anyone in the Premier League. He was seen as the future, really, of Premier League forwards. It's gone wrong for him since. I think if you at Roma, the one thing you'd be guaranteed is to work under a very attack-minded coach in Gasperini. His teams always score lots of goals. He's just arrived from Atalanta. Revitalise careers. I mean, Ademola Lookman was somebody that he's now been linked with. He was being linked with Paris Saint-Germain not that long ago, but certainly, could get a move away from Atalanta this summer. And you look at his career was just drifting, really. And Gasperini just gets hold of forward players, particularly, and wants them to score goals. And he actually, if you look back to his previous teams, particularly Atalanta, he does like a sort of big, traditional sort of number nine type striker to hold the ball up, to bring others into it. So, I mean, I think those would be the upsides. The downside is that, Roma's a very demanding club. And if you don't start well, there will be competition for places. And, as I mentioned right at the top there, I just think Ferguson needs to be playing and just playing regularly, because, that just hasn't happened for too long now.
Yeah, here's hoping it does kickstart. Perhaps kickstart isn't the right phrase, Paul, but reignite his career.
Yeah, you would like to. You would like to think so, and I agree with Mark with Gasperini and his sort of track record of producing players and bringing them on a level or two. That is absolutely what Evan needs. I just hope he goes there, Shane, and plays consistently. Like, I think the move to West Ham was full of hope back at Christmas, and it obviously didn't work out for one reason or another. So maybe coming out of the English football environment will maybe just take him out of the firing line for a little period of time with regards to eyes from an Irish perspective, and hopefully he can kind of get going again, because he's still going to be such a fundamental part to our qualifiers that are coming up around the corner. But yeah, listen, here's hoping. He's so much quality in his game. He just needs to get going again, like as you said.
Needs a little bit of luck. Manchester United can't fix the roof in Old Trafford, but they're splashing the cash in the transfer market, Mark. Will they get Emi Martinez as well?
Well, I mean, he is available if they're prepared to pay the release clause for him. I think Aston Villa sailing fairly close to the wind in terms of PSR and you know, need to get a couple of players off the wage bill as well to kind of reinvest. I mean, Emi Martinez's his last game was actually for Villa was at Old Trafford, wasn't it, when he got sent off after coming charging out of his goal. This might be controversial. I've never been his biggest fan, Emi Martinez. I think he is capable of brilliant saves, but I think for an inverted commas world-class goalkeeper, he doesn't have make sort of a lot of mistakes and a lot of things go past him that I think he should save. But he is capable of the spectacular. I think United are definitely looking at sort of Premier League ready players. We've seen that with Cunha and Bueno that have already arrived. I don't think that they can afford to be wasting time on too many players that are going to take 4, 5, 6 months to settle. And you know that Martinez is kind of Premier League ready. Anan has been a disappointment. I think Amorim would like to swap him for a different goalkeeper. So I could definitely see why it might happen. Like I say, he's not my favourite goalkeeper.
No, they needed Wessel Spiel from Minnesota United.
I actually played with Emi Martinez. He came on loan to Sheffield Wednesday. And I am surprised by how well his career has gone. But one thing he was never short on was confidence, I can tell you that much.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and his distribution was always good, very good with his feet. And obviously that would fit in with kind of the modern goalkeeper. But yeah, very surprised with the career he's had.
Is he the larger-than-life character off the field as well?
I think the majority of goalkeepers are.
Yeah, no, that's fair. Would you rate him? Or would you have concerns similar to Mark Langdon?
I mean, he's done wonders for my CV of players that I played with.
You no longer play with him here, so get off the fence here with these political answers, Paul. You could, I doubt Emi Martinez is listening to 2FM.
I doubt he remembers me, to be honest with you. What he wants to say is, you can do with two goalkeepers.
Well, perhaps. Paul, what does Brian Mbeumo bring to Manchester United?
Good question. I mean, he's consistently scored a lot of goals in a side that Brentford wouldn't have been renowned as being kind of like a top half team. So he's definitely got quality when it comes to kind of dribbling and being a threat in the final third, creating chances and scoring goals. So you'd like to think that he can bring that into Manchester United. A lot of the time last year when we saw them in wide areas, they didn't have that sort of killer end product that maybe some of the top sides in the division do have. So you would be hoping he can bring that into Amorim's side and kind of contribute from that side of things. But we've seen a number of players go in there, Shane, and have come off the back of good seasons or off the back of good 18, 24 months and not be able to produce it at Manchester United. I think that would be the biggest concern I would have for likes of Cunha and Bueno. It's a completely different ball game, completely different expectations playing for Manchester United compared to, in all respect, to Brentford. But he's certainly shown a lot of quality in the last couple of years with the numbers that he's put up, and Man U fans will be hoping he can do something similar in their side.
Mark, how Liverpool spent wisely with Hugo Ekitike from Eintracht Frankfurt?
Yeah, I mean, I was speaking about him, I think it was on last week or maybe the week before show, when there was discussions about him going to Newcastle, and I said, I thought he's a fantastic player, certainly in terms of potential, and there's no doubt that he is potentially very exciting. So yeah, I would say that Liverpool, it's not cheap, clearly not cheap, but they're spending the money this summer and they're buying somebody that I think eventually will play through the middle, but doesn't have to play through the middle. He can start in wide areas and drift in pretty much the same way that Gakpo has done for Liverpool. He can play wide or through the middle. I would just say that I think that Ekitike's got sort of gears maybe that Gakpo hasn't got, just in terms of that potential frightening pace, you know, good ability in the box, but can also, like I say, play in those wider positions as well. And that is where I think is really different for somebody going into Liverpool, because you're not necessarily needing to suddenly hit the ground running and score 20 goals, because they've already got a number of forwards, particularly Salah, that can do that job. And I think that just makes it slightly easier. If you go into Manchester United, for example, like the pressure is on to deliver straight away, whereas at Liverpool, you've already got sort of the basis there of, you know, a winning team, and you know that Salah's going to deliver. So, no, I'm excited by the signing. Saw him play in the flesh when he the Eintracht Frankfurt played in the quarterfinals against Tottenham. He looked like their best player in the Europa League last season. Scored a great goal in the first leg as well. So no, I'm excited by that signing, albeit it's not a cheap one.
Okay, stepping away from transfer news, the Women's Euro semi-finals begin this evening. Italy against England, 8 p.m. live on RT2, and the RT player tomorrow, Spain against Germany. We can hear from England's Georgia Stanway and the England boss, Serena Wiegmann, now.
Yeah, I think it would be really disrespectful to Italy to think that we're the favourites. I think they made the semi-final just like we did, and that's very impressive for any team that makes the semi-final. So complacency is just the biggest mistake you could make. We've seen them all. You've seen them all, how they've played. So there's, yeah, I don't think there's anything that we could think that we might be the favourite, but we have to be at our very, very best to win the game.
George, I wanted to ask, this is your fourth consecutive major tournament semi-final. Does it ever get any less nerve-wracking? Does it get easier with time?
I didn't even know. So yeah, you telling me that is...
Have I made you nervous now? Sorry.
I'm already nervous. I'm sweating to be sat here. Yeah, I'm very grateful to be in this position. And I think it's just credit to the whole of England in terms of, yeah, us getting this far, the squad, the depth that we have. And yeah, just how important it is to have, like I said, such depth in the team that brings such quality. And you can see it in the games that we've played so far and how important the substitutes have been and the finishes of the game. And they've come on, they've scored, they've made a difference. And exactly like the Euros last time, we relied so much on Alessia and Tooney coming on and changing the game at about 60, 70 minutes. And it's exactly the same this year. Yeah, you see the strength and the depth within the squad, and utilising it is the most important thing.
Italy obviously had the extra day. They only played 90 minutes versus 120. How much is sort of the mental aspect of recovery going to be as important as physical in terms of being able to make up for that difference?
Yeah, well, we were just really happy that we had an extra day compared to all the other games we played so far. So, and this extra day really helped us. And yeah, we're in a stage now that we're ready.
Mark, Alan Colley was fairly confident last night. England are favourites. Would you share his optimism, or... You a bit like me, thinking they've played for about 15 minutes in this whole tournament.
I think you could sort of say both are true, really. I think that England are favourites. They should win, even though they've not been at their best. But I do agree that they've not been at their best for large parts of the tournament. But Italy, for a semi-final, you know, I know they've changed formation and have looked better since they've moved to a back three. But I think England are, you know, quite a bit better than Italy, even if they haven't sort of reached those standards as often as we would have liked so far. I haven't seen the team news yet, just to whether Williamson's been past fit. I mean, that would be a concern because I know, just talking there about the depth of the England side, and somebody like Beth Mead, you know, can come off the bench. And I think in attacking areas, absolutely England have got depth, but that would be a sort of an issue for the semi-final if she's not fit. But England are better than Italy, and if they play to the standard, they should qualify and reach the final against Spain or Germany. I mean, it'd be a whole new level that they'd have to play in that final. But in terms of the semi-final, I think that this is a game that they should win.
Paul, would you agree?
Yeah, I would. I actually think it'd be comfortable if England show up tonight, and they might only have to play well for 25-30 minutes. I think they could punish Italy. I just think there's too much of a gulf in class between the two sides. But absolutely keen to see what sort of a side Wiegmann goes with. Like, Chloe Kelly did extremely well when she came off the bench in the quarterfinal against Sweden. And a couple of their bigger names have been slightly off kind of max gear, what we're used to seeing from some of those players, to Ruby's point. So I wouldn't be surprised if there's one or two changes just to freshen it up heading into this semi-final. But you would expect England will have too much.
Okay, great stuff. Just before we take a break, are Shells going to frustrate Carabag tomorrow night, Paul?
I wouldn't be surprised. I don't think they'll go through over the course of two legs. I think Carabag, when they get to their home fixture, will be a completely different beast. But tight pitch, Shells in the middle of the season, Carabag are another side who are kind of just exiting their pre-season at this moment in time. I don't think there'll be a huge amount between the sides tomorrow. Hopefully Shells will have something to hang on to, whether that be a draw or they could nick a win. Be a big ask, but I don't think there'll be a huge amount between the two sides tomorrow.
Okay, Marie will be previewing all of that with our Association Football guests on tomorrow's show. Mark Langdon, I know you're a man of many talents, but I'm assuming you're not across Azerbaijani off-season news or anything.
No, I'm not. Not only that I would expect Karabag to win over the two legs, but I've not been following their pre-season too closely.
That's fine. We'll allow that. Okay, Shane Stokes is standing by with the latest from the Tour de France. Mark Langdon, Paul Corrie, thank you very much. Lots more to come. Stick with us here on Game On.
This is 2FM's Game On.
Now, we mentioned at the top of the show that Ben Healy just missed out on a stage victory. There was high drama. Shane Stokes, writer with Velo website, joins us now. Shane, what happened today?
Oh, it was an incredible stage. It was really, really, really dramatic. Ben Healy was in the breakaway from early on, and they gained a significant amount of time on the other general classification contenders. So he had started the day 10th overall, and all the riders ahead of him were back in a group with 12 kilometres to go, nearly 6 minutes down. They were on the Mont Ventoux climb, one of the most famous climbs in cycling. And he battled all the way to the summit with the Frenchman Valentin Paré-Pantre. And it Healy looked the strongest. He was doing most of the work, but it came down to a sprint, and Paré-Pantre just got him at the line. It was very, very close. So Ben Healy will be frustrated, but did move up the general classification as a result.
Yeah, typically aggressive ride from Healy. Up to ninth in general classification. What's a realistic target for Ben now?
Yeah, it's interesting because there's three tough days to go. Tomorrow was more for sprinters. Saturday's stage looks like it could be a breakaway stage, which all things considered, Ben would target, except for the fact that he is getting, you know, the top 10, the overall, is going to be very hard fought in the next few days. So there are two stages, Thursday and Friday, and they're both summit finishes, and they're going to be really interesting to see how he fares, because if he keeps the current level of form, he could certainly move up. What's interesting is at the end of the stage today, there's a Norwegian rider, Tobias Halland Johannesson from the UNOX Mobility team. He actually collapsed to the finish, was given oxygen, and has been taken to hospital. It's a little bit evocative of Stephen Roach in 1987. You might remember he collapsed on the La Plana stage and was given oxygen. So, he is just 51 seconds ahead of Ben Healy in the overall standings. He's in eighth place, so it'll be interesting to see, does he continue in the race or will he be forced to stop?
Okay.
One report I read, Shane, said he was taken away unconscious. Could that be right?
I heard that he regained consciousness, or he was conscious, so I'm not sure if he had lost consciousness at some point or not. He was definitely given oxygen, so there's a little bit of a lack of clarity at the moment. His team did say afterwards that he was suffering from stomach cramps during the race. And what is, I guess, a little bit frightening about just the location for this to happen is that in 1967, Tom Simpson, the British rider, died on Mont Ventoux. He collapsed several kilometres from the summit and died. It does happen in sport that people push themselves to the point of exhaustion. But just, I suppose, with the location of today, it gives it an additional frightening element.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. Also, just in terms of riders actually dropping out, a notable name, Mathieu van der Poel, forced to abandon the tour due to pneumonia.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he was diagnosed with pneumonia and didn't start today. Now, he's been one of the aggressors of the race. He's one of the most talented riders in the sport. He was a big name to exit the race. But I guess it shows the toll that the Tour, a race as hard as the Tour and as long as the Tour can take, people can get all sorts of health issues during the race and injuries, etc. So you always get withdrawals from the race. And he's the big name this morning that didn't start.
Speaking of names, Tadej Pogacar is, 4 minutes and 15 seconds in front of Jonas Vingegaard as they stand now. His quest for another Tour just looks relentless, yeah.
It does, but the gap between them is closing all the time. Now, Vingegaard may run out of road because he has only those two summit finishes to try and make up time, and to take four minutes 15 seconds back is going to be a massive task. He was the aggressor of the two of them on the climb today, and Pogacar did put in an attack near the summit, didn't distance Vingegaard, but it was very much the Danish rider who was doing all of the attacking. He was gapped very slightly at the summit. He lost a further 2 seconds, but the gap is closing between them, and if the race was a week longer, you might see the pendulum swinging completely the other way. But interestingly, I spoke to Sean Kelly before the Tour, and he said because Jonas Vingegaard had a concussion in earlier this year and had several months out of racing, he felt that he could be stronger possibly in the third week. So it does seem that the tide is turning, but It's going to be fascinating to see can Vingegaard really make inroads into that lead in the two remaining summit finishes.
Just on Tadej, and interestingly, we'll be speaking to Remy Burns a little bit later on the Goliath that is Scotty Scheffler. Shane, you had a really nice feature on a Velo website on Tadej Pogacar, kind of the human side to this cycling icon. You spoke to a number of people who are close to Tadej. What did you learn about him as a character, as a human, as a person, and indeed what drives him and who support him?
Yeah, I spoke to his mother, I spoke to teammates, I spoke to team staff people as well, and I spoke to actually two rivals, which would be the Irishman Eddie Dunbar and the Australian Michael Matthews. They're both on the Jayco Alula team, and what was most interesting, I suppose, was, I mean, I suppose talking to his mother, she talked about him teaching himself to walk at 11 months of age, that basically the family weren't the ones driving it, that he was trying to walk, kept falling down, kept standing up again. So there was, I suppose, a stubbornness and I suppose a certain amount of coordination at that age. And she just talked about him being a person that once he started cycling, that he just really wanted to win, wasn't massively put out when he didn't win, but just got such a kick out of winning. And she suggested he had this athletic drive. But speaking to Eddie Dunbar and Michael Matthews, as I said, they race for rival teams, but they do train with him in Monaco, and they both are really speak very highly of him away from cycling, but just as a person. And they talk about his modesty, that he realises what he's achieving in the sport, but that they feel he's very modest, very down to earth, and just good company to be with. And that seems to be the perception. I mean, on the one hand, he's trying to win everything in the sport, and there's a little bit of resentment that he's dominating, and you always get that, I suppose, with people who dominate so much. But some riders have questioned the appetite for victory, and that there's no room for others to take wins during the Tour. But it seems that there is also an affection for him amongst his rivals. You see that with Mathieu van der Poel and Remco Evenepoel, that they interact with him in a kind of respectful and quite jovial way. So, yeah, it does seem that he has a charisma that that makes up for any rivalries that happen on the bike.
You mentioned the words that Eddie Dunbar spoke about Tadej Pogacar and during your interview with him. Actually, we can hear a bit of Eddie Dunbar speaking now, and you begin by asking Eddie about the occasional training rides with Tadej and what his impressions of him are.
Me and Tadej, we always do a couple of easy rides together, recovery rides, drink a good bit of coffee as well, so that's nice. But I always say to people, he's one of the best. He's the best cyclist in the world. You know, he's probably going to go down as the greatest ever. And that aside, we're very good friends off the bike. And as a person, he's a great person. You know, myself and Niamh were close to him in Urska, and they're wonderful people. You know, outside of cycling, which is always nice. to get to know people like that too. And yeah, as I said, I have a lot of respect for what he does and who he is on the bike, but off the bike, he's a great person.
I'm curious what it is about him off the bike that you like so much.
He's just a good guy, and he's very humble in a way, you know. I wouldn't say the results he has or anything gets to his head. He's just someone who genuinely enjoys riding his bike, and he does it because he loves it, you know. Yeah. It's not because there's any pressure there. He genuinely is someone who just loves getting on the bike every day and competing and racing to win. He's a racer, and he just goes to be, he's probably the best racer in the world. But he's not afraid to go to the classics and race and be super competitive there, win some of them, gets podiums in the monuments and wins a lot of them as well, and then goes to Grand Tour. So that's someone who just loves cycling and loves it for what it is, and results followed that. But as I said, off the bike, he's very humble. He's aware of what he's very aware of what he's achieving, which he should be because it's incredible. But he's very humble along with it, and as I said, just a good person to be around.
The Niamh Eddie references there is Eddie's partner, and Erska is Tadej's partner, who is indeed an accomplished cyclist in her own right. There's been a bit of a sea change in recent times in how the top riders behave, Shane. Years ago, they were a bit of rivals. Tour rivals would trash talk each other, sniping about perceived slights, playing psychological games. Is Tadej a driver in the change away from that?
I think so, yeah. He's seen as very extroverted and quite charismatic compared to Vingo, who is much more introverted, much more withdrawn. But even so, there just seems to be, how will I phrase it? Back in the year of Armstrong, there was a lot of psychological games, and he would be, I suppose, manipulating people like Jan Ullrich, who was his big rival. There was almost like a Stockholm syndrome between them, in that Ullrich was, praising Armstrong, etc. And Armstrong would often be quite antagonistic towards him. And he just, apparently Armstrong struggles to understand modern sport and, the fact that competitors can fight so... bitterly is the wrong word, but they can fight so intently against each other on the bike, but then afterwards shake each other's hands, congratulate each other and be quite friendly. And apparently Armstrong struggles to understand that. So, yeah, it's quite a change in the sport. You can think back to the era when Sean Kelly was racing, and he would have had quite bitter rivalries with Eric van der Aarden. There would have been Greg LeMond and Laurent Fignon, and to some extent Greg LeMond and Bernardino. There was tension there. And then Stephen Roach and Roberto Visentini. And it just seems nowadays that people get along better. I'm not quite sure. It'd be fascinating to hear a sports psychologist. Does this extend to other sports? And if so, what's the reason for it? But it has been quite notable in cycling in recent years.
We might put that question to Austin O'Malley next Monday. Who knows? Listen, for now, Shane Stokes of the website Velo, thank you so much for outlining that. You can read more of that really fascinating feature on that website, Velo, by Shane Stokes. From one sporting icon to another, Ramy Burns is going to be detailing the rise and continued dominance of Scotty Scheffler.
This is 2FM's Game On.
I think we live now in a day and age of where, clickbait is kind of what people look for, and you can shorten a 5-minute clip into, three words. I think really underestimates what I was trying to communicate. Maybe I didn't do as effective of a job of what I would have hoped to in communicating that, but, at the end of the day, I have a tremendous amount of gratitude towards moments like these. I've literally worked my entire life to become somewhat good at this game, to be able to play this game for a living, and it's one of the great joys of my life, being able to compete out here and to be able to win the Open Championship here at Portrush is a feeling that's really hard to describe.
I have no doubt it's a hard feeling to describe, but calling himself somewhat good, Ramy Burns, is a fair understatement.
Yes, it probably is. I mean, we've just witnessed the number one player in the world, and when he starts to putt like the number one player, like the number one in the field, and then hits his irons like number one or number two in the field, it's a combination that's probably unbreakable, and it's going to be very difficult for people to smash through that standard. He's quite an incredible player, and the amount of commitment that he puts into the game and his control of his distances. To me, I was out in his game twice, Thursday and Friday, and it's quite phenomenal. He's certainly at the top of his chosen sport at a very, very high level. He's setting a bar even coming closely or past even what Tiger Woods set.
It's the control of his emotions, his mood, his temper, his control of everything. He just looks machine-like.
It's very machine-like. Like, we did see after December there, he hurt his finger and he was out of golf for a little while, and you could see a little bit of frustration with his game up until maybe April. Then he won a few times in April, which he had never won before in April before, and he started the season sort of a little bit later than he normally does, and it's certainly a reflection on his game. And he was maybe, you know, let's say losing the head, but he's getting a little bit angry with himself in a few of the early tournaments this season. But he certainly has worked on his attitude on the golf course, and his commitment to each shot. It was like his last shot. That's what I saw when I was with him. Every golf shot he played was like his last shot. And it was just on incredible golf. And the flag positions in Portrush were hanging on edges of greens. And he was able to stop the ball and hit it a lot closer than the rest of the players in the field. And that gave him an easier set of putts throughout the whole week. And the putter was very hot. And if somebody was getting to 17 or 18 under yesterday, he probably would have went to 20 or 21. He just got the lead and there was no one passing him. And Tiger Woods was the man, the best at that. I think he's led nine tournaments now from the 54-hole lead, and he hasn't been caught once.
He is just relentless, Remy. That was the brilliance of it. The part I probably most was getting the enjoyment out of was the crowd on Saturday, the atmosphere that was chasing Rory McIlroy around Portrush. It bounded out of the television. What was it like live?
It was hair raising. Like I've done a lot of these Opens and been with a lot of players, and I brought home different winners, and the Woods Molinari in Carnoustie, like, was my sort of, this is unbelievable, Tiger Woods and Molinari down the last 11, from 11 through, and the cheering. And but not to have Tiger Woods on the golf course and see Rory with the fans going around the golf course, is like the Pied Piper and this like legion of fans. And the thing that struck me the most was that, 80-year-olds, children in prams, young kids, fathers, mothers, like, five or six three generations of people following this guy around. Like, he is the biggest crowd puller. We all know that. He's in Northern. It doesn't matter where he goes in the world, whether it's Ireland, Northern Ireland, Scotland, America. He just has that aura about himself, and he certainly set a standard of crowd noise. I mean, his reception on when he made the cut was incredible, and then there's reception on Saturday, but the reception on Sunday, I was standing there going up that fairway, Robert Lee, and like Robert does a lot of television and does a lot, but he had never in his life ever seen a standing ovation in an open grandstand. I had never seen that before, and everyone stood up, and it was quite hair-raising.
Just very briefly, Remy, I know we're a bit pushed for time here, but I did hear Rory thinks the sharpness he had at the start of the year has returned, and although he's insisting it's not because of Scotty's success, that's not a motivating factor. Is Rory where he needs to be now with a slight eye towards the Ryder Cup as well?
Yeah, I think Rory is struggling a little bit with his driver. He's struggling finding the club face. He knows that. He shot 10 under. He fought very hard, but he didn't have his A or B game. He probably had a C game, but he certainly, I thought the last maybe 30 to 40 holes, there was a different Rory there. And I think after the winning the Masters and winning that major that has eluded him for a very long time, I think he's got back on the horse now. And I think you'll see a very strong Rory McIlroy. He knows how hard he has to work to achieve the Scotty Scheffler, to get up to Scotty Scheffler's standard of golf. And I think Rory's well capable and well able to achieve that other notch, that extra, B and A game. He'll get there eventually. There's very good parts of his game, but he just struggled a little bit with his driver, in my opinion.
Okay, great. So, Remy Burns, thank you so much for taking the call this evening. This evening's programme was produced by Ronan Lawler. Our broadcast coordinator was Laura Lee Davis. Marie is back tomorrow to chat Gaelic games and association football. For myself, Ruby, all of Game On team, it is bye for now.
This is 2FM.